Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest is the poet Paula Bohins. Paula Bohins is the author of two poetry collections, both from Saraband, The Children in 2012 and Incident at the Edge of Bayonet Woods in 2008. Her poems have appeared in The New Yorker, Poetry, The Times Literary Supplement, Poetry London, and the Yale Review. She has received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Amy Clampett Trust, and the Breadloaf Writers Conference, as well as the Discovery the Nation Award and the Amy Lowell Poetry Traveling Scholarship. She lives in Pennsylvania and is the 2012 Dartmouth Poet in Residence at the Frost Place. Hi, Paula.
Hi, Renee.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you start us off with some poems?
Mm-hmm. I'll start with the title poem of the collection, the newest collection, which is called The Children. If the wind had been less gutsy in its unbindings, we'd know them better, the children, or the afterimage of them. The teenage couple wrapped inside the field after the rave has died and dispersed into corn, into cars, into the trashed curfew. We'd know them, the two who lay here, ecstasy lowered to ache and dull grin, glow sticks faded against colorless weeds. If the wind had been less federal, sweeping anew the corn dust, and the clouds that kept them starry for hours, now passive against the noon sky, if only they'd lasted. If we'd been given more distinct evidence beyond the condom listing against milkweed, the fox prints, the warmth of glow sticks in our hands, neutral again, broken of their magic. Those dirty pacifiers we suck, the whistles we put to mouth and sound. This next poem is called Mother's Quail. In the copse of her mind, a fluster of quail, tonic of quail, each her own failure, boozy and flush from briar, by a panic gripped from kin to kin. So they hover, mother and daughter and daughter and daughter, large-bodied, terrified, though nobody wants them. Cloud of quail, eyeing steeple heights but failing, her covey backlit and looming, huge as buckshot when it balloons down, scribbling earth with its landings. They tell a tranquilized fortune, days of luckless labor and sadnesses too frail to utter. Shoulder to shoulder they fail, the quail of her actual and the quail of her oblivion. This poem is called The Dogwood. The dogwood was not canine, not human, but angelic. What a fragile word, itself on the verge of breaking. Original beauty, hems flaring, seeming to signal to the dedicated, love is with us. But love was not with us, and beauty was not with us. It's flowering a star in the farthest corner of our universe. But when the infernal sun would finally sink, it took the dogwood's halo with it. The tree became pain, lifted out of goodness. Dress gone fiery at the edges, naked emotion was what we felt. Recognizing ourselves in stark wood, weak uplift of branches. Misery gave us solace. Courage rushed to each bare place and filled it. This poem is called Owl in Retrograde. In truth, she must move more like a rodent, claws scuffling the puny branch without pity, and feathers fitted as newspapers closed around the decayed field mouse in the garbage. She's not been cleansed of malice by her open face, even when the kill is clean. Prey swept from its running like a plane pulled up at liftoff, punctured on both sides, flown swiftly through the phantom dark. My poor puppet, embodied psychosis, giver of a few luscious moments in a lifetime. A husband hearing the ghostly blowing first, shushing his wife, both of us listening hard, the soft column of silence between us meaning, you've made me a home. Where self-loathing used to reside, it has been banished, the roof of us enameled and moonstruck as a compass. Though the owl is homeless forever, isn't she also moonstruck? And glad, I hope, to return, flaring like a match in all this sadness. This poem is called The Hive. The hive hangs high, the gaze is high upon the ill-fated head. Sloughed emblem, its combs a bolus of sugar and virus. What is a man if he's not thinking? Shame and generational fury, dreaming of hexes, teething the vivid fruitwork of country art. Wax degrades, honey bitters, the bodies of bees go missing, the vines turn rope, the hive obscured. Those who've made a picnic of looking are left to record it. Children, scowling and strange, the fruit of the hive tree, who point.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Paula Bohintz, reading from her new collection, The Children. Something that is very striking to me about your poetry, almost immediately, is some of the really surprising and fresh decisions that you make with your language and with vocabulary. I mean, you have phrases that are things like, the wind had been less federal and a fluster of quail. And then you have these moments of like flaring like a match. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in how that's part of your craft, how you work with language that way to come across those moments that are so surprising in that language that's so unique.
Oh, thank you for saying that. I think with the way that I write, I need a lot of quiet time before I start writing a poem. I'll usually begin by reading other poets' work to sort of sink into that space of language. And then I'll just sit by myself for a little while. And so when I'm writing, it really is a little bit of an unconscious experience. And that's, I think, where maybe those little, maybe surprising choices are found. And even maybe as I'm writing it, I'm not exactly sure how it's going to mean in the poem. And sometimes those places are edited out if they seem too disjointed with the rest of the poem. But for the word federal, for example, in the poem The Children, I really wanted it in some ways, reading it again, to mean sort of this broad, wide sweeping. And so, that's sort of, I guess, how I approach word choices and things like that.
So things sort of filter through this. I think that there's this space in your mm-hmm. poems. They feel spacious. They feel like they're in this zone of kind of suspension, and that there's room made through your attention to the images and to the language and through the rhythm of the poems. There's room made to focus on what the poem is focusing on. It sounds like maybe that comes from that space that you make for yourself when you're writing. Is it similar, how you develop these images that you have? I mean, you have some really, The Children especially has some really wonderful, this sort of surveying of these ordinary things, like the condom and the milkweed and the glow sticks that are dying. Mm-hmm. But they're expressed really beautifully in the poems.
Oh, thank you. A quality that's really important to me in poetry, the poetry that I most connect with as a reader, are poems that are really clear. As a reader, I have a hard time sometimes going through poems that seem like especially dense or difficult, intentionally so. And it's sort of my job as the reader to really spend a lot of effort wading through. Or if it seems like there's no breathability, that's a difficult experience for me as a poet. So I'm sorry, as a reader of poems. So I think as a poet, I've tried to internalize that. And it's not only creating a space for myself when I'm writing the poem that's sort of clear and open, to be direct, because something that's really important to me also is an emotional connection. You know, I definitely want people to feel something from my poems because that's what I want to feel from other people's poems. And I think there's a clarity that's necessary, at least for me, to experience the poem in the way that I want to. That makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can you read us some more poems?
Yeah. This poem is called Hornet's Nest. Wedged in the shed's upper left joist, like the sun in a child's drawing, cut down and carried to the kitchen like a trophy. I set its ruffled self in a red bowl, centerpiece beside the salt, memento of an afternoon I told myself, but it was their home, durable and chambered and stolen, or abandoned, I theorized. It tilted, like theory made material, sheaves of starched or hurried hours. I thought of the hornets, hoisting themselves with foreparts, minute mathematicians each carrying a curve of idea. Is there proof lost forever without a witness or a ledger? Empty rooms crying yes and yes and yes. This poem is called Everywhere I Went That Spring, I Was Alone. In the single room of a bathtub, humming Love Me Tender to hear a sullen human voice, then after, fainting in slow motion to the tile, succumbing to steam and waking on my own, drowsy as a rose. Mailing a letter and waiting, empty, beside a hornet's thumb-small home, fit inside the lip of the mailbox. The hornet each day startled less by the sudden thunder of the falling drawbridge, the symbol of sunshine let in. In the kitchen, beside the toaster, crying unabashedly into dish tiles as I timed my meal and kept company the cool block of butter in its iridescent silver, the blunt knife, the beveled glass that carried my milk. Alone when it began to hail one afternoon, a miracle suspending the cottage in darkness. Alone taking a photograph of the glory, and alone when the pearly melt returned the grass to ordinary June. Everywhere those months my nose buzzed from crying, quivered so unlike the hornet, pitiless in her work. Bleeding intermittently into my dress hem, how beautiful I became then, ringed by brown flowers. More hornet than my hornet friend, alone in her own collapsing universe. This poem is called Entering the Ooze, and it refers in parts to Virginia Woolf's suicide by drowning herself. First, the bad boots give up their strength, then the toes lift their anchors. The ankle bones are broken, and so on, until the bladder lets go without shame and the genital organ washes away the ovum and her fertile signals. A proxy pain stands in for the larger intangible. Has nothing to do with tufts of snow blown upon the unforgiving surface, but how I mistook the beauty of those particle deaths, their of the world stardom, as a kind of metaphysical river, that if I looked long enough, with enough reverence, Let my waist, blood numb, stand in for that miscalculation. And the severed friendships in the current's wake, the bloom blown off the stricken self. I saw formal water, knowing my body wanted to go there. My only child, how I've betrayed you. Snowbirds. The ones we called snowbirds won't return this year nor the next. The crows, jostling for a few kernels hidden under a layer of frost, know this. The impatience, blackened and thin beneath the tarp's best efforts, sense there is no saving, there is no bringing back. Last night, what we believed to be their children, crying for the suet we used to wrap in stockings and tie to the feeder, was a mistake, though that place has become a totem to their absence. Now it is too late for the snowbirds, for us. The feeling we had looking at them has left. Nothing replaces it. This poem is called Froth of the Tides and the Further Out. A dime delights flesh before entering the economy of a pay toilet in a cafe overlooking the Atlantic. One grilled window filtering a wan sun. Sun becoming moon in the modest, womanly room. Pointillism of fog softening glass. Tiles seafoam green, mimicking the ocean, surgery, old money, though the air has a poverty feel, black blood flecked in the bowl. Still, I'm renting time, saying in mind, beauty rescues over the waves otherwise suggestions, hiss and recession, white noise, the coarseness of the world against the hope of that phrase. Beauty rescues. Is that true? I was dead. Then God rewound my life to its origin.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Paula Bohins. One of the things I find interesting about your poems is the way the poems engage nature and operate with nature. It's clearly more than just a setting for the poems, and it seems to operate also differently than just a plain description, or a subject, or a symbol. Can you talk about that, how nature works for you in your work?
A poet whose work I really love is Henri Cole, and I remember him saying once that symbols of nature, birds and animals, sometimes served as masks for him to be able to express human emotions through their imagery. And I think that I use nature in a somewhat similar way. It's easier for me sometimes, instead of using an eye, to sort of communicate what I'm trying to do through a little bit of an adjunct symbol. So I think that that's part of it. I think that a lot of sort of my concerns in poetry are beauty and symmetry and clarity and intensity. And I think that animals and nature really exhibit those qualities. A bird can't be more of a bird than it is. And they're just these perfect representations. And so I think that, you know, like poets throughout time have always been attracted to these symbols. And I think that I'm just another one of those poets.
Beauty is something that's come up a couple times in your reading so far. Can you talk more about what you're exploring there? Because I think that the poems themselves are beautiful. The language is beautiful. The rhythm to the poems and the attention to sound and the way that sounds relate in the poems. And there's also a recognition in the work of what a fragile word, you say at one point. Mm-hmm. So there's this idea of beauty, and then there's also this questioning of beauty that happens. Mm-hmm. I think in the last poem you read, I think it's, does beauty rescue us?
Right.
And it seems like a the idea of beauty, of course, is something that comes up in artwork. It's something that we explore as writers and as artists. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what it is that hooks you about that, mm-hmm. what it is that you're going after.
I think that for me, poetry has always been somewhat of a sanctuary. It's been a place where I can, through writing it, sort of craft a world, shape a world, and reading it is entering someone else's crafted world. And I think that that's very seductive, I guess, for me to think about escaping into another world mm-hmm. that is beautiful. And I think that sometimes my questioning of beauty comes from sort of experiencing some uglier things in real life and wanting to not necessarily reflect that in poems, but transform them into something. I think for me, it's a way of trying to take an experience and reshape it. I think that maybe that's why.
I think that's really interesting, especially given how crafted your work appears. Do you want to read us some more?
Sure. This is the last poem in The Children. It's called Spring. Larvae harven into adults, into the complexity of distinct anatomy. Windowed wings, legs like stitches, tossing off the sodden blanket of the soft body, their innocence lisping over the pig, oomphs and fizzes forming a transcript of triumphs. But what does it mean to win out here? Spring's raffle. Who will live? Who will become distressed and wish for a place to climb in? I'm watching the air fill with the born again, resting on the corpse of the rotted oak. Tomorrow I'll drag it, chainsawed to thick tablets, into the woods. No tragedy to watch it go. The insects have broken from that burrow into warm air. Snow has melted from bark and pooled, with nowhere to turn, making this place so fertile. I'm going to read a few poems from Incident at the Edge of Bayonet Woods, which was my first book. This poem is called Resurrection. As evening comes, Mary Magdalene and Mary the Mother inhabit the rubble outside the tomb, a tangle of crying, ordinary mourning, nothing yet risen, no visible alchemy. Only linen and dust bits hesitating behind stone. Brittle carapaces of beetles to keep company the human husk. The drama of earth nearly finished. Judas hanged, silver buried in the fields of blood. Trio of spirit days in which the women wait, their harmonic wailing ended. Rustle of the exhausted vessel. Plum pits roll from fingertips onto ground, flies gathering at the echo of sweetness. Then he walks out. Brief the reunion, and long the second grief, with nowhere to keep vigil. This poem's called Quarry. Supposed dragnet for the past, but that net is empty, save for a few scattershot leaves, a limp posy blown wide open. Better if I could lie eye level with this ocean, if I could quarrel with these rocks, woo outrage the way I woo sorrow. There ought to be a slow forming fire somewhere, not these pale mists, which are moths, which are offerings of light to the foiled landscape. If I could raise my eyes to the house, its frost-stained window, where my father sits beside his shaving mug and brush, his face looking out onto the rest of his life. Greenish stubble of weeds waiting for some emotion to occupy it, though emptiness is its own kind of balm. This poem is called Acrostic Outhouse. Once this homestead held many children, uncles and great uncles, delicate and stooping aunts tatting lace all day, needles replacing husbands who disappeared into bayonet woods, never returning, obsession becoming gems of fine knots until their men thread wholly into white roses, sadly filigreed, as the wild roses edging the outhouse are eaten by beetles. So this is the opening poem from The Children. I'll just jump back to the Children for one more poem. It's called Pussy Willow. Faint as flame in wind, I was born, cupped inside a fist and carried everywhere, even to the formidable river, so I might see the stones of the riverbed. Now, Pussy Willow, hacked and bundled by gloved hands for hours beside that river, is all I remember of childhood. How branches scrape past my window like antlers, half cleaned of velvet, of illness, true antlers bent against a snow-ridden field. By candlelight, Pussy Willow has returned, unaltered, to a city hardly real. Virus in my heart, branches salted with buds, soft-eyed on a sill. Brutally the Robin. Brutally the robin clutches the clear muscles of the ice-laden branches. Without a scrap, without a word, he is sentenced in red pajamas like a deposed king. This is the world's revenge against masculine beauty. The bold color it granted, it withdraws, whole, in bold statement. His eyes are black-rimmed, his fluted bones could lift if they wanted. But where, at this late hour, to what embassy? He belongs to the void now, that prairie, and is starving, I said.
The poetry of Paula Bohintz. Thank you so much, Paula.
Thank you so much for having me, Renee.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 FM.